Colin Kay is a cartoon enthusiast and collector with Silver Kay Gallery. Joins us on the program this morning to take a look at the lives of William Hanna and Joseph Barbera. Hello, Colin.
Good morning, Trevor.
Colin, firstly, where do they fit in with the other animators or big animators around that time being Disney and Looney Tunes?
Well, you know, Disney, needs to say, which was the giant of the animation world, had created a bit of a classic feature that we know, Snow White, Pinocchio and Fantasia. And they had been making those for theaterettes, which, you know, had cost, you know, even in those days, their budgets were set at millions of dollars. And Warner Brothers, Chuck Jones, Fritz Zilling, the famous animators that worked for those studios, were doing those wonderful, you know, six-minute cartoons for the theaterettes with Bugs Bunny and Daffy Duck. And Bill Hanna was born in way back in 1910, and Joe Barbera was born in 1911. And both these guys had, in their early years, had associations with, for example, Bill Hanna had worked with a guy called Rudolf Ising, who was making cartoons for Warner Brothers. And interestingly enough, Joe Barbera had actually applied to work at the famous Disney Studios, and he was knocked back. And he said, actually, the old saying of sliding doors, he said, thank God I was knocked back, because you may well have never had Hanna-Barbera Studios, because he said, I would have disappeared into that great sort of a chamber of artists that did work at Disney, and they were extremely talented men, but I would have just been a number in a group of many famous animators that worked there. And they really came together, Bill Hanna and Joe Barbera, in 1937, when they both worked at MGM Studios doing shorts. But they struck gold when they created that famous couple called Tom and Jerry. And this became literally a worldwide hit. The first one of those came out where Puss Gets the Boots in 1940, and that the series Tom and Jerry actually won seven Academy Awards, featured, you know, the mouse, which was called Jinx, and Tom, who was Jasper, and a funny little bulldog called Spike. And it was really interesting. Even back then, the talents of Joe and Bill Hanna working together. Joe was incredibly talented at doing storyboards and sketching the poses, whereas Bill Hanna had this amazing ability to get the timing, so you get your jokes right, so the whole thing flows beautifully. So even then, their ability to come together to create cartooning was starting to come to the surface, and the Tom and Jerry thing went right through to about 1953. I think the last one they made was one called Dangerous When Wet, which featured Esther Williams in it. And even in those early days, the both of them working at MGM were starting to draw into their company old famous Disney artists. Disney was really the engine room of animation, if you will, and it had many amazing animators that worked there. And a guy called Ray Patterson came to work with him, and he'd worked on Dumbo, and a guy called Ed Benedict, who had done amazing layout work with Tex Avery from the Warner Brothers. So the world of animation were slowly coming together under their guidance at MGM.
Colin, is that why we saw, I think, is it in Ships Ahoy or Ships Away or something that we saw Jerry actually perform with, is it Gene Kelly?
Gene Kelly, he danced with, that's quite right, he danced with Gene Kelly. In fact, we had a wonderful cell that Hanna-Barbera actually produced many years later, and it featured Jerry dancing with Gene Kelly. And interestingly enough, it's a really good one you bring up, Trevor. Gene Kelly had actually gone to Disney and asked him, look, I'd like to make a cartoon or offer my services to do a similar thing. And Disney had knocked it back. And he then approached MGM, who had this cartoon division. And that famous, I think it was their second last tune, came out. And, so Gene Kelly and, as I said, Esther Williams also worked with them. But the really interesting development was that in 1957, MGM decided to close their cartoon division. And so there's Bill Hanna and Joe Barbera without a job. And it was at that point that they decided to create the famous Hanna-Barbera Studios. I was very lucky many years ago to go to the old building in Hollywood where they founded this wonderful studio. So they came together, started to make some cartoons under their own company name, Hanna-Barbera. You know, not much money, struggling to build a studio. And they created a wonderful character called Rough and Ready, a dog and a cat. I don't know if you've ever heard of this cartoon, Rough and Ready, but a classic. In fact, I have some old cells from that cartoon. And this was really their first major cartoon couple of characters under their own label. But that was just the beginning, because then they had to try and sell it. And this is where they ran into a real issue, because they were approached by a company called Screen Gems. They'd gone around. Bill Hanna, it's interesting, Bill Hanna at that point was basically doing a lot of the work on the cartoon. Joe was doing it too, but Joe was also out there trying to sell it. He was the man trying to sell it. And a company called Screen Gems, which was associated with Columbia Pictures, said, okay, look, we'll try and sell it, but you're going to have to make it cheaply. We're going to give you a $3,000 budget, which in those days was just unheard of, because, making cartoons of MGM and all the other, six-and-a-half-minute cartoons, it cost, in those days, somewhere between $40,000 to $60,000 for a six-minute short. And it would take 8 to 9 weeks production. And this was suddenly thrown out the window. They wanted them to produce one a week, $3,000. And this is when they, the world suddenly discovered this amazing creation, which was created by Bill and Joe, called Limited Animation. And this was a step in a whole new direction. And basically, what it did was take a six-and-a-half-minute cartoon and make it for 90% less by actually reducing the number of drawings dramatically that were used to create the cartoon. And that was done by, for example, animation is 24 cells a second. They reduced that to 12 cells a second. The character poses were held much longer. The movements, you remember with you only have it looked very stylized, and they would zero in on the faces, on the character's face. And so they were able, actually, through many different avenues, to reduce these costs to $3,000. But interestingly enough, they got the cost down, but Columbia Studios and Screen Gems, a guy in this, no, we're not interested in this, we don't want to know about it. And a director from NBC suddenly heard about the Rough and Ready show and said, look, I think we'd like to try that in a children's show. And this was really the birth for Hanna-Barbera on television. They ordered 52 shows, and that was really the beginning for Bill Hanna and Joe Barbera.
Colin, so what's happening here is that, and especially it works perfectly for television because they can make it cheaply, they can bring them out quicker, and that's why we tended to see more of the Hanna-Barbera productions on TV and not necessarily as shorts for film or within film.
Well, that's correct. NBC had decided they would make this approach to do it on television. So really, you can say that Bill Hanna and Joe Barbera brought the world of animation to television. But that's easy to say in words, but the steps of actually making it happen were just huge. And so the very first ones that came to the world of television, which we all know, Huckleberry Hound, Yogi Bear, Quick Draw, McGraw were the first characters that really gave birth on the TV. And some famous guys like Don Messick with voices, and Thor Buckle with the voices, and other characters started to emerge, Wally Gator and Snugglepuss. If you try and actually go through the lists of all the characters, it is just a Hanna-Barbera story is massive. But then there was another massive, huge change that took place. They were approached by NBC to do a half-hour situation comedy, but to pump it out in literally a week. And this was, again, unheard of. But Bill Hanna and Joe Barbera are incredibly talented and incredibly productive. And this innovative and daring idea of a half-hour sustained cartoon situation comedy, they thought initially was unworkable, but they did it. They pulled it together, and of course, the very first one that came out, which everyone knows, which gave birth on September 1960, was The Flintstones. The most probably one that, I mean, even to the gallery today, we still have young kids coming in asking for The Flintstones.
We've got a couple of people want to talk about Flintstones. If you want to join us to talk about any of the cartoons that have been put together by Hanna and Barbera, or just any questions about their lives and how they put together so many cartoons that we know and love, 1-300-800-222. George, good morning.
Good morning, sir. You're doing a good job, and Colin too.
Good morning.
What I was ringing about was Fred Flintstone and Barney Rubble. I used to love them. You know, they were really funny.
Well, all those wonderful characters of the Flintstones, Fred Flintstone and Wilma and Barney, and, of course, the dogs, Dino and Astro, their whole world of the Flintstones. And, of course, the kids, Bam Bam, was just a wonderful character. The whole series of characters that they gave birth to in the Flintstones. And interestingly enough, they were also drawing into those early days for their animation, other animators that have worked at Disney. There was a voice guy called Alan Reed, who was actually the voice of Fred Flintstone, and Gene Vander Pyle. She was the voice of Wilma. So they were drawing all these amazing people in to create that wonderful... And that cartoon actually ran for 6 years. It ran right through from 1960 to 1966 and won so many awards.
Sue wanted to talk about them as well. Hello, Sue.
Hi, Trevor, Colin. I just wanted to talk about when you said earlier about that the cartoons weren't just for kids, that the Flintstones actually involved a lot of relationship issues, really. When you think about the women, before the kids were, before Pebbles and Bam Bam came into the series, the women used to run off with their charge cards and go charging, and the boys used to sneak off and try to play golf and then tell each other fibs about different things. So it was a lot about, it was actually a lot about married life, if you reflect back on it, and then what the kids brought in once they had their kids. So it's actually a whole of life story, really, not just a simple cartoon.
And so there were the appliances that were used and all of that sort of stuff.
Yep. And the car was funny for the kids with the feet making it move and all that sort of stuff. But even to the point where they, you know, he'd put out the cat on the milk bottles and you know, he'd mow the lawn and do all those sorts of things. Very much everyday life, you know, and or some things that he hadn't done. You know, she was always on his back about doing this, getting a better job and, you know, doing all, he was always trying to get a better job doing something and, you know, all that sort of stuff. It's amazing when you think back on the storylines of how sophisticated it was. It wasn't just for kids.
There's a couple Colin.
Well, I think that's the great strength of Hanna-Barbera. They really bought animated characters into the family television room and basically gave us a look at ourselves. I mean, that was their great strength. And you see them all in their family car heading out with Dino running along beside them. You see them walking along, taking the dog for a walk, and all those wonderful... I mean, there was a wonderful cartoon where he's playing Tintin bowling, and that's the great strength of their cartooning work.
One of the things within that, because if you take a look at it, though, there are other sitcoms that were reality sitcoms, like The Honeymooners.
Correct.
That were around at the same time. So it really tapped into that, what was happening on TV then as well.
Well, that was Jackie Gleason's The Honeymooners. And, that was exactly right. In fact, it was, you know, it was really built almost around that. And they did that with many parts of the cartooning world that they worked on. I mean, the Flintstones was this massive success, and then they started to bring out all these other wonderful cartoons. You know, Top Cat, which so many of us know, and of course in 1962 was the in 61, Hey There, It's Yogi Bear came out with Boo Boo and all those wonderful characters around that, and they were constantly creating new characters. I mean, and the Jetsons came out in 1962, and it's interesting to see when that cartoon came out that actually Bill Hanna co-wrote the theme song for that. So these guys were not just creating cartoons, but they were creating many of the things that go around the cartoon.
Did they almost bring out too much? In that, did it get lost a little bit? Because when you got Huckleberry Hound, and you mentioned Wally Gator, which probably aren't recognised as much as the Jetsons and maybe Top Cat. Was there just so much that they were bringing out?
Well, that's a really good comment, Trevor. They brought out a power of animation. In fact, by the end of the 1960s, Hanna-Barbera had cartoon shows on each of the three networks on Saturday morning. That's never been done before or since. The Simpsons is on one station. That's huge. But these guys were bringing it. And remember, each one was taking a week of work. So they had a team of studio animators bringing out three a week that were featured on all the three networks. And other great cartoons or characters like McGilla Gorilla started to come out, and Space Ghost, which were action adventures with a science fiction touch to it. But Dastardly, and I'll come back to that in a minute, but in 1969, they brought out the wonderful one, Scooby-Doo, Where Are You? And I was very lucky. In late 1990s, I brought out Iwa Takamoto to Australia for a tour of Australia. And Iwa Takamoto, the wonderful strength of Bill Hanna and Joe Barbera was they were hands-on at that studio, but they brought to them raw talent. Iwa Takamoto worked at Disneyland and on such things as Cinderella and Lady and the Tramp, and he came into that studio, and he actually created Scooby-Doo. So there's a man working for Bill Hanna and Joe Barbera. He actually created most of the dogs, Astro and Bruno and all those characters. And he was the most wonderful man to meet. And I spent a lot of time talking to him. And he said that Bill Hanna and Joe Barbera, they were right beside him. They would check everything, the storyboarding, the timing. They never let go. And he said they were the most wonderful couple to work for. He said they were amazing.
Actually, it's interesting when you mention that. When you take a look at the animation style, it's very similar to some of the Japanese animation that was coming out at about the same time, perhaps a little bit later. Was there a relationship between them?
I don't think there was, Trevor. That's a really good comment. That stylized animation look, which was really... They invented that. Now, I'm not sure this, but I suspect that the Japanese... animators would have actually copied what they were doing in the form of the way to do it,
yeah.
Through the limited animation approach. But they continued to pump out all these characters, Speed Buggy and Ghostbusters, and then, of course, and they moved through the 60s, 70s, and they constantly were creating things. In the 80s, the Smurfs came out, and one of my all-time favourites, which I just absolutely love myself, was the Wacky Races. I don't know if you know that one. And
I
mean, who doesn't know that? And they had these 10-minute segments centred around a motor car race and part of an ongoing competition that covered every corner of the ground. All these wonderful characters, Bowler Mobile and the Slack Brothers and Rock and Gravel. And, of course, the big one was Dastardly and Muttley. And I think, and, you know, even today, I still get so many kids coming into the gallery asking, oh, do you have Scooby-Doo or do you have Dastardly and Muttley? Don't think that because this was television for the 60s and 70s, 80s, that it's died in the hearts of young people. Parents are showing it because they love it for the kids, and the kids love it just as much. It's timeless.
Actually, on that, Simon said one word when it comes to Hanna-Barbera, Muttley, fondest memories as a kid.
Well, yeah, he was such an amazing character, and that's another character Iwa Takamoto created. In fact, I had a wonderful night one night at the gym. We had about 300 people there, and Iwa stood up in front of all these people and actually drew Dastardly and Muttley, and it was to the guys. And he wasn't the voice of those characters. They had other people doing. They had so many wonderful people doing the voices. We had a lot of kids there, and he started doing the voice because he's working around it. He hears all the, and the kids were incredulous because these characters exist. It's a bit like, it's like so many in The Simpsons. These characters actually, they're live for children. They actually, we know they're animated characters, but for kids they're live. So when he started in the voices, the kids just looked at him and said, well, why is he doing that voice? They couldn't believe what they were seeing or hearing.
Dick wanted to talk about the Jetsons. Hello, Dick.
Yes.
Hello, it's Dick. Yes. I was a big fan of the Flintstones, obviously, in the mid-60s. And the interesting thing back then is, it was on, you know, television, obviously, but there was limited productions. You couldn't get images of the Flintstones or these characters. And I was a kid of about 8 or 9, and I was quite artistic, and I used to draw pictures of Fred and Barney and sell them to the kids at school for, you know, 20 cents. But I thought the Jetsons, for the time, was very futuristic in terms of you know, their transport, the building they lived in, and those vacuum lifts that went up and down.
We all love love the Jetsons, and it's interesting the comparisons and the similarities with the Jetsons to the Flintstones in a lot of ways as well, Colin, with the dog and the all of that sort of stuff.
Same, very similar approach. A family from the future, the Jetsons flying around in their ship. And your gentleman there just rang in. It's interesting you should talk about you doing the drawings, and I often hear that. And it was really only in about the late 90s that the Hanna-Barbera Studios offered the opportunity for you and I to be actually able to buy some of those wonderful cartoon cells. And that's where we became involved. We became their licensee out here, and they actually offered these cells signed by Bill Hanna and Joe Barbera, so you and I could actually own a bit of that wonderful issue with these guys. Remember, when you make a cartoon, there are many, many, many cells. So they didn't actually draw them directly themselves, but they had the animation, but they signed them and gave us the opportunity. And as you say, the Jetsons is one of the things. I always remember that wonderful thing where, you know, George is... Now, today, everyone knows what a treadmill is, but in those days, there's George out walking with Astro, walking on the treadmill. No one knew what it was, but think about that. They were actually looking into the future and things that actually came into reality today.
Now, you haven't even mentioned, because my two favourites were Adam Ant as a kid and also Squiddly Diddly. I love Squiddly Diddly. And he very rarely cops a mention when you take a look at Hanna-Barbera cartoons.
I must say, in all the years that we have been involved in this, I don't get many people asking about that character. So, Trevor, I don't know where that leaves you in the parliament.
I love Squiddly Diddly.
But that's the wonderful thing about the amazing range of characters that these characters, these gentlemen created. I mean, the Banana Splits was a wonderful thing. And Magilla Gorilla is one of my favourites. And I don't get a lot of people coming out there, but that's a bit out there left of field. But that was their great strength. They created all these left of field characters.
How did they go into Banana Splits? What took them in that direction? And there was the cartoons with Banana Splits, but why did they decide to move out of the format where it was held together by cartoon characters, even with those series, and decide to do it with really large puppet characters?
Well, look, that was the great genius of Bill Hanna and Joe Barbera. They were always looking for the next big thing. They were always looking to step into another direction. They had a... whether they themselves actually created Banana Splits, I can't answer. I mean, the studio created it. But by the time they were getting into those years, they had the most powerful number of animators working around them. As I said to you earlier, Iwa Takamoto created Scooby-Doo. So they had these men pouring in these ideas, and they were really gelling it into these wonderful cartoons such as Banana Splits. And, of course, in the 90s, they went into other directions too. Their studio really ran right through from 1957 when they created Rough and Ready through to the 1990s when they were doing many other science fiction cartoons and such. But their real strength and the cartoons that we all know, Top Cat, the Jetsons, Johnny Quest, the Herculoids, Hey There, it's Yogi Bear, that was their swan day, their marvellous days.
Tony, good morning.
How are you, Trevor? Hello, Colin.
Good morning.
Yeah, hello, mate. I wanted to talk about the Wacky Races, but I just want to ask another question. I heard that if you had a childcare centre, Hanna-Barbera would be happy for you to have their characters on the window without fear of prosecution, whereas Walt Disney, the Disney Foundation, would pursue it and make pay for the
rights. So are they a little bit more free and easy with their copywriting, Colin?
Look, that's... I don't know whether that's... they had a... Disney had created a character way back in the early 20s when he was working on the East Coast American, and he lost that character. So when he started his own studio, he made sure that he owned all his characters. I know there's no question that Hanna-Barbera would have copyrighted their characters as their studio developed. But I actually had Bill Hanna in the gallery in the late 1990s, and the way he was prepared to offer everything and anything would be very reflective of the comment your guest there just made on the phone. I must say, though, I was in Adelaide And I found a lot of Disney stuff in actually the Adelaide Hospital many, many years ago. And it's a long time ago. And they actually got me down there to look at them and try and value them for them. So I don't quite know the answer to that one. But I do know they were very easy to deal with. Very, very, a lot easier than the Disney Empire.
What did you want to say about Wacky Races, Tony?
I felt that all Australians sort of had a rehash with the name of Peter Perfect, as in Peter Brock, you know, like we used to always like, you know, like Peter Perfect suited Peter Brock to the T. You know, he was just a perfect racer. And I think that invigorated that character a little bit more as time went past.
Yeah, like actually, you're probably right. But Colin, I'm not sure that they would have been thinking about Peter Brock at the time because it came much later.
Peter Brock on their mind. But I mean, we think of the other wonderful ones in that cartoon. Penelope Pitstop was one of my absolute favorite. I mean, they had so many. They had the bulletproof bomb, which was a Model T managed by a group of sort of pint-sized gangsters called the Anthill Mob. And they just had all these wonderful names. Funny, when I was talking to Iwa Takamoto, he said, can you imagine? He said, there's a bunch of guys here. We're in our 50s. They're throwing sort of paper airplanes over each other's studio at each other. He said, one day he was sitting, working in his little studio. And Iwa Takamoto was a small man. He wasn't big. And suddenly, three animators rushed in, picked him up, and hung him up in the cupboard. But the whole animation studio, he said, was just a bunch of kids living their childhood world. And so what you gentlemen just said, it's all captured in this childhood humour. That's what they were creating.
1-300-800-222, text us 0437-774-774 if you want to join us as we take a look at the lives this morning of Hannah and Barbara. 1-300-800-222.
Tomorrow night on ABC TV and iView, catch Diary of an Uber Driver.
Thanks, mate.
Yeah, don't forget to give me 5.
A 5-star series.
How'd you get started with Uber anyway?
Some things changed for me.
From the smash hit blog and best-selling book.
I got lots to think about.
Like?
What I'm supposed to be doing.
Diary of an Uber Driver. Tomorrow night, 9:30 on ABC TV and iView.
Colin Kay, cartoon enthusiast, collector and director of the Silver Kay Gallery, joins us this morning as we take a look at Hannah and Barbara. I was interested to read, though, Colin, that Mel Blanc did voices for them as well. Was there a little bit of movement between the different animators and animating countries with people that did voices?
There was a huge movement, actually, Trevor. Mel Blanc is probably one of the most famous characters in the world of animation. When we think of Mel Blanc, we think of Warner Brothers because he actually did the voiceovers for all most of the Warner Brothers characters. There was a wonderful piece that came out called Speechless many, many years ago, and it featured all the Warner Brothers characters with their head bowed around the microphone, and it was just celebrating, after he passed away, the life of Mel Blanc. Yes, he worked with Hanna-Barbera, but the actual voices of, for example, of Fred Flintstone was a guy called Alan Reed, and a lady called Jean Vanderpaar, which I mentioned earlier, was the voice of Wilma. But he was just so talented, that gentleman. His voice work was everywhere. But that was the world of animation in the 60s in Hollywood was a crossover of all the studios. Hanna-Barbera had brought animation to television, and they were drawing all these. Mike Maltese, who was just a wonderful layout man, he came and worked for them for a period of time. Ed Benedict, who had worked at the Disney studios, he was drawn to them to do work there. They were pulling in amazing creative talent, and you must remember too that in the mid 60s, when Walt died, Disney closed down their studio for a while. It really wasn't until Lion King came back that the Disney studio. So all these animators suddenly didn't have jobs. Two famous animators, a famous Disney animator called Paul Carlson, who was a great friend of mine, started his own studio. And they were just making small TV productions, but suddenly they had this opportunity for the Hanna-Barbera studios to get full-time work again.
Sid, good morning.
Morning, Trevor. I just wanted to mention about an Australian famous cartoonist. Well, I think he used to do Blinky Bill. I think it was Goro Yoss. I'm not sure of his name. You'd have to look it up. but he was quite prominent with cartoons on TV with Australiana.
Yeah, we did have our own animators, didn't we, Colin?
Well, that's a really good point. We haven't been greatly associated with animators that worked in Australia, but there is some massive talent in this country, and I see some of these guys when they come into the galleries. And, you know, if today, for example, you go to things like Comic-Con or Supernova and you walk around there, you'll see booths with local artists, you know, either redrawing some of the famous Batman and Superman and all those characters, or some of the own characters that they've created. There is great talent in this animation in Australia, but I do know a number of these guys who end up going to America basically to make a living, because that still is the powerhouse of animation.
Someone's asked whether or not Top Cat was based around Sergeant Bilko.
I'm not sure about that.
People would draw similarities between a lot of programs and find similarities again with a lot of them. Dave, good morning.
Good morning. How are you, Griff?
Good, Dave.
I just got up about 10 minutes ago to put another log on the fire, put the radio on, and I don't know the background of, didn't hear the beginning of your guest where he's talking. He mentioned Australian animators, was his experience mainly in animation or American?
Well, at the moment we're talking about Hanna and Barbera.
Yeah, in America or Sydney?
Well, did they operate out of Sydney as well, Colin?
Well, that's right. Look, my experience, I've been lucky enough to represent the American studios out here with their animation art for many, many years. But for a while, there was a studio in Sydney that particularly did some Hanna-Barbera work. And for a time there, Bill Hanna was basically stationed there at the studio doing work. Why they put it in Sydney, I'm not quite sure, but it was there for a brief period of time. That's quite correct, and I would have imagined that they would have at that point been drawn in a number of Australian animators to work on their local studio, and they did actually produce some episodes in Sydney. That's quite right. You're quite right with that.
One of my clients managed the studio. Jack Petruska was his name. He's a great guy.
Oh, how interesting.
Yeah. And
what year was that, do you know?
That would have been about 1980, I guess.
Yes, that's right. That was the period when they were there. And I remember when Bill Hanna came out as a guest of ours, I asked him quite a bit about the studio, and he said it was wonderful and it was very creative. I think, I'm not quite sure whether the cost restraints caused them to close it down, but I know they did a lot of animation up there for a while. They also, you know, a lot of the studios sent animation to some of the countries, like in those days, it was cheaper to do some of it in Japan and other countries, even though it was licensed, really, so they would do the drawings simply because of the cost, and then all the sales would go back to America for the actual cartoon release.
Lewis, good morning.
G'day, Trevor. How are you going?
Good.
Well, I've been watching a bit of Banana Split on YouTube lately, and I'm just cracking myself just laughing so hard because I swear those guys are all stoned.
Is it the cartoons that you enjoyed as well as the Banana Splits themselves, or both?
Oh, just Banana Splits. I mean, I show my kids and I go, this is what we grew up with. And now when you look at it as an adult, not as a kid, you go, they're stoned. This is the 1960s. They're off their trees, mate.
You say, yeah, we were a bit trippy in the 60s, Lewis.
Yeah, it came out in 68, actually, Lewis, and it was really Hanna-Barbera's first foray into live action with the slapstick antics of the Banana Splits themselves, and characters like Fledge the Dog and Droopy the Lion and Pinko the Gorilla. They had such amazing characters around them.
What were the cartoons that went with it, Colin? Do you remember?
Sorry, what's that?
What were the cartoons that were on with Banana Splits?
Look, at the same, well, interestingly enough, in the same year that the Banana Splits came out, which was exactly the same time that they released Wacky Races. I mean, they were doing this real, you know, left-of-field, edgy material, and so they were just constantly generating these brand-new things that we'd never, you know, it's when Darcy and Muttley came out, Muttley with his funny little sound, and they were just constantly creating these new, wonderful characters that none of us had ever even knew existed.
What are they thought of as amongst animation purists, in that it was very simple, the style of animation, in comparison to taking a look at Disney, especially Disney, but also when you take a look at Looney Tunes as well? Is it recognised as a very separate art form but still recognised as being important?
Oh, look, there's no question about its importance, Trevor. I mean, when you look at Disney animation, and think about this, when they created Fantasia at 24 cells a second, some of the Fantasia cells took, because of the speckled colours they were using, the translucent colours, some cells took 12 hours to do 1/24th a second. Each cell was an artwork in its own right. But because of the brief that Bill Hanna and Joe Barbera were given, they had to be incredibly creative to create that, the cartoon at $3,000. That was their budget. Now, as time went on, that was lifted, and so they were able to do more and deeper animation. But there's no question, whenever you think of animation and the birth of animation, needless to say, you think of Warner Brothers, you think of Disney first, and Warner Brothers and Hanna-Barbera. They're the big three. Hanna-Barbera stands in its own right very powerfully.
Ralph, good morning.
Oh, good morning, TC. How are we?
Good, Ralph.
I was just thinking that, honestly, it's, hey, 60s were good to me. I'm still tripping. Anyway, I was in Hanna-Barbera Land in Australia's Wonderland in Sydney.
Is there a Hanna-Barbera Land?
There was. It was like it was awesome. It had a little roller coaster, all the gear, but for the little kids, you know. It was great. Anyway, where they had the characters that walk around and everything else. Anyway, there was a little gate where the characters came out, and anyway, right beside it was the entry to the men's toilets, which sort of had that little privacy screen. So I'm walking to go to the toilet. Anyway, the gates are opening, and here comes Yogi Bear and Boo Boo, and they're all coming out the gate, see? And, of course, limited vision in those suits and that, and I've gone left, exit, stage left, into the toilets, you know. And then right beside me, on the other side of the screen, was Yogi Bear. See, and I've gone, hey, smile the average bear, boo-boo. Where's that picnic basket? Well, I thought the head was going to come off this costume. He was looking around everywhere, and I ducked away. See, I'd gone out of sight. It was so funny. It was like, totally took him by surprise.
I must say, I didn't know that existed up there, and I had a wonderful opportunity way back about 20 years ago to go to the old Hanna-Barbera Studios in Hollywood. I actually toured through that, and they were still, you know, working there. Unfortunately, today it's all been pulled down, which is hard to believe that they actually took that famous building and demolished it. While I was there, I was watching the animators work, and you could hear them sounding all the voices and making all the noises that you're talking about. And it was magic. It was absolutely like you. I can hear you when you're talking. It's magical. You never forget it.
It's one of those, because I got a text here saying Scooby-Doo and Shaggy constantly had the munchies, says Tony. But is that one of the things they also managed to do, was to take a look at what trends were? And with Scooby-Doo, and especially when you take a look at that character with Shaggy, with the hippie-type character, is that something they managed to do as well, as to keep track of trends?
They were dipping their finger into science fiction. They were dipping their finger into action. They were dipping their finger into all sorts of areas. And he was said that was one of the great, wonderful things of working at the studios. You were always being pointed in another direction, looking. And of course, the Jetsons was looking into the future, and they were constantly being creative and trying to find new directions. One of my favourites was the Perils of Penelope Pitstop. Do you remember that one?
I
mean, that was just wonderful, where, you know, Stanley has got the girl tied up at the chair, and they were always looking for something new and something different. And as I said, it wasn't just their powerful creative input, it was the guys around them that were working for them, doing the layouts and the design. They were always looking at life to see how they could reinterpret that into their cartoon work. In fact, all the studios, I remember, here's a wonderful story. I was talking to Chuck Jones one day, and he Chuck Jones worked at Warner Brothers and created many characters, and he said he was sitting in his studio, and he heard the guy walking down the studio floor, and he heard the guy, he was carrying the uncut rolls of the films for the cartoons, and he heard him going beep 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 beep, and disappeared in the distance. He said, "Oh, use that one day." And of course, mit 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 mit, we all know what that comes from. They were always looking for something to use in their cartoon work.
John, good morning.
Oh, good morning, yes, gentlemen. I'm just wondering who created Mighty Mouse, because that was popular in the cinema and Oil Can Harry. And then there was, on television very early, was Crusader Rabbit and Tom Terrific with Manfred the Wonder Dog, which were pretty basic cartoons. Maybe you could make a comment about that.
Yeah, because I mentioned Adam Ant earlier, which was very, very early. Mighty Mouse was even earlier, wasn't it, Colin?
It was earlier. I'm not actually quite sure who... Adam Ant was, of course, a Hanna-Barbera production. I'm not sure about Mighty Mouse, whether that came out of the Hanna-Barbera stock or not. There were just so many characters that were pouring out. You said before, Trevor, did they create too many? Well, perhaps they did, because I can't answer that question.
Geez, he had a fine tenor voice, though, did Mighty Mouse.
Do you remember Speed Buggy and Funky Panther? I mean, there were just so many different characters that were pouring out all the time.
Morning, David.
Good morning. I'm just digging out. Bev asked me what cartoons I had from the Hanna-Barbera studio. Well, the first one is one I had them do for me of Popeye for a barbecue placemat. It's Popeye and his wife and holding a little baby and a dog, and he's over a barbecue and spinach on the ground.
Did they do Popeye?
No, they didn't do Popeye. That was another studio. They didn't create Popeye. But again, it came out in that early period of time. But that wasn't a Hanna-Barbera production. No, it was not.
David, thank you. I haven't got time to go to Jason. Jason wanted to talk about movie spin-offs. We've only got about a minute to go, Colin. What was it that saw the end of their productions and their work?
Well, look, you know, age catches all of us, and it did slowly with them too. They actually started to step away from the actual production work, basically to run their business. It was so big, and they started touring the world to promote, and that's when we managed to get Bill down here, and he did that big exhibition we had, and it just time caught them after a while. But they were basically very much in that. They were running their studios from 1957 right through to the early 2000s when I visited the studio there, and that's really, they slowly started with withdrawing and just basically retired, but the studio itself kept going and is going today. But then it was bought by Warner Brothers. I don't know if you're aware of that. Warner Brothers bought Hanna-Barbera, so that's under the Warner Brothers label.
So and so many of them are still operating, and if people still want to watch Hanna and Barbera cartoons, there are so many places to do it. Colin, thank you very much for joining us on the program.
Thank you very much for having me, Trevor.
Colin Kay, cartoon enthusiast, collector and director of Silver Kay Galleries. And thank you to everybody who joined us. This is Overnights on ABC Radio Newstime.